session number 11363, reel 1.
Mr. Withers, reel 1. Whereabouts were you born, Mr. Withers?
In a place called Loy in Stourbridge, near Stourbridge, North Worcestershire.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a miner.
Were you educated in Stourbridge area?
Yeah, just a local council school, you know. So.
How old were you when the war broke out?
39, the war broke out, so 22. I'd be 17.
Were you in a job then?
Yeah, I was working then, yeah.
What kind of job did you have?
I worked in, it was a steel, they made structural steel work, you know, for electric poles, you know, the overhead wires. And the steel work for the tops of these poles. And, you know, general steel work.
Do you remember Chamberlain making the announcement that we were at war with Germany?
Yeah.
What were you doing then?
Well, we were all waiting by the wireless, you know. We just got the wireless. And we were all sitting by the wireless. I think it was Sunday morning, wasn't it? It was about Sunday morning, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
How did you react to it?
Well, I can't recall, really, you know. We were all a bit apprehensive, I suppose, really.
Had you expected it?
Yeah, I had. I was not surprised, no. Because it was leading up to it, you know, all through from the very start. From the time Hitler took out, moved into Austria first, didn't he? I think it was Austria.
Were you living in the West Midlands when the Blitz occurred?
Yeah, when the Birmingham, we weren't affected really by, we had the odd bomb drop. It was only a stray, you know, it was unfortunate. But Birmingham took the brunt of it, which was about nine miles away. Well, 8 miles away.
Did you see anything of the bombing in Birmingham?
No, just the sky at night, you know, the light. I worked at the firm later on. When the bombing was on, that was in the 1940, wasn't it? When the,
yes.
The bombing was in 40, 41. When the bombing was on, I'd moved my job, and I'd moved nearer Birmingham then. And I used to do, we used to have to do fire watches, you know, at night. You'd do so many nights. I think it was one or two nights a week. People who worked in the factory had to do fire watch. And when there was a raid, if there's no raid, no air, no alarm, you could sleep all night. They got camp beds, you know, on the firm. You could sleep all night, no bother. But if there's an air raid, you patrol around looking in case there's any incendiaries dropped on the premises. And you could deal with them, you know, whatever.
How did you deal with them?
Well, we didn't get any. We were fortunate. The nearest thing we got was anti-aircraft shell unexploded, dropped with perhaps 200 or 300 yards away from the work. But
where was this?
Langley, a place called Langley, near Oldbury, which is not far from Birmingham.
Near Oldbury?
Oldbury, yeah, that was then Worcestershire. It's all part of West Midlands now, but that was Oldbury. There's a lot of chemical works there in Oldbury. We were right by the railway line. Opposite, on the other side of the railway line, there was a firm called Albright and Wilson Chemical, and they made all these phosphorus for the incendiary bombs.
What factory were you in?
The firm I worked for was making the .5 belts for the .5 Browning machine guns in the Spitfires and Hurricanes. They're just the belts, not the ammunition. They were the gun links, what they call gun links. They were, not hard to describe what they looked like.
Were the belts made out of metal?
No, metal, yeah, they were steel. Tensile steel. It's hard to describe. When you put the round in, you sort of link the other one to it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
There's two two holes, two blocks, the one side, and one the other, you see. When, and if, I started to describe it, I had a few minutes. Anyway, they're gun belts. And when they when the round was fired, that just dropped out of the plane. It was scrapped, you know, they never used it again after.
The belt was just discarded?
Yeah, it just dropped. If you see some of the old film, you might just get a glimpse of, you'll see bits flying off. That's the belt coming away from the gun. See, the six gun, you can imagine six, well, I think it was six each side, or no, three each side, but it only three.
Varied.
Yeah. Well, all that was, you know, disposable, throw away.
How many people worked in the factory?
Oh, it'd be about 400. Mostly girls on hand presses. Yeah.
Had girls traditionally worked?
Oh, yes.
In this area?
Yeah, always. It's always been girls. Originally, they started off, they started in Birmingham, the firm did. And it's established nearly 100 years then, the firm. Well, after the war, I think they celebrated their 100 years.
But originally, were they making
pen nibs. That's their original.
So when did it turn over to making machine gun belts?
That would be about, just while I was there, be about 1941, 40 or 41 when they went over to that. And they really went, you know, into it. Well, up till then, they tried to keep a certain amount of export business going. That was a policy, you know. And they did send out a limited amount of export. Pen nibs and stuff, yeah. All
right. What was your job in the factory?
I was in the dispatch, in the packing dispatch, in the warehouse.
Where would they be sent off to, these machine gun belts?
They go to one of the, it would be one of the war ministry contractors would arrange, one of their transport, you know, firms, they contracted for the ministry, they'd have an arrangement for them to collect them. They would collect them.
So you didn't know where they were going to?
Oh, no, no, they just went to some, to be an RAF, MU, you know, the maintenance unit. There was, I don't know exactly where, I think some might have gone down Banbury Way, Oxon, you know. I've no idea really, you know, I suppose they were scattered all over the place. And there was also, I think at the first stage, there was a lot of subcontracting, you know. They would, a firm would get a contract and they'd subcontract out to smaller firms, you see. So not necessarily a direct contact with the ministry. But their inspectors used to, there were permanent staff of inspectors from the ministry there to inspect the work. It was all inspected.
Were they very particular about the quality?
Oh, yeah. Had to be up to a certain standard, you know.
What kind of complaints would they make about the quality?
Well, it had to be smack on, you know, the size. They got certain tolerances they had to keep within. And, of course, if it didn't come up to their spec, you know, they'd reject. They never persistently been pressed to make more, you know, the production.
For the war effort?
Yeah, why? Yeah. Were
you conscious of that at the time, that there was all this pressure on to produce more for the war?
Well, everybody, everybody just went about the normal business, you know, and tried to, they all did the best. Well, the girls, a bit piecework, you see, and that didn't make a lot of difference to the young girls, because they'd always had to work hard, in any case, to make the money up, because they never overpaid, you know. If they didn't work, they didn't, you know, get anything like a wage. How hard they worked depended, you know, it depended on how hard they worked, the wage at the end of the week.
So when they went over to piecework, were they making good money?
No, not necessarily, no. Not in that particular firm, no. They were always piecework from day one when they were on pen nibs. It always worked, peace worked, they got old. And there was a policy then, in the old days, so they'd fix a price, and the girl, some of the girls could make good money. And they'd drop the price then, and they still got work so much harder. So, you know, a lot of that went on. So the one, the lame ducks, they were earning, you know, very little, while there were just a few who could earn good money, you know. That's how the system worked. But it was nearly all piecework. All the girls were piecework.
Was it all girls on the production side?
Mostly, yeah. There'd just be... men were in the minority by a long way. The only men employed would be in the polishing section, perhaps in the plating section, and tool makers and tool setters, you see, and foremen and supervisors would be men. But there'd be the... I don't know how many men worked there. There wouldn't be above perhaps 50, 60, 70 men.
And presumably either very young or elderly.
Yeah, oh yeah. Some would be in reserved jobs. You know, if they're skilled, really skilled toolmakers, they'd be in reserve, see. They'd have to be a skilled toolmaker to be in the reserved occupation.
Mm. What were relations like between the men and the women in the factory?
All right, everybody, you know. The women, most of the girls, they came, see, Langley was near Birmingham, and it was really not classed as the Black Country proper, you see. The Black Country was Dudley, Tipton, Wensby, and all around that area. But Langley was more nearer Birmingham, nearer the big city. And it was not so much thought of as the Black Country, but it was adjacent to it. And the Black Country people were always harder working, for the most part. And they'd work for less. Pardon? Than the townies, the brubbies. They were known as brubbies, you know. There's always a lot of rivalry. That we were looked upon as country bumpkins, you know, people living in the big city always thought of us as being a bit, with a lot of rivalry, but never came to blows, but just that, you get that everywhere, in your local rivalry, as you go, you know, he's come from so-and-so, he's just, you know, all in good part, you know, nobody ever really got uptight about it, but
so for the most part. How does this connect with the relations between the men and the women in the factory?
Well, and they got on very well. You know, I never recall any trouble. We never had any bother. You got some of the foremen giving the girls a bit of favouritism. Well, everybody got the favourites, haven't they? You know, you've all got it like and dislike.
Making favourites of particular girls.
Girls, and giving them a little bit extra. You know, they'd get the best jobs, you see. And there'd be a bit of jealousy. They say, oh, so-and-so, she get all the best jobs they've done. But for the most part, it all there. They'd have a little bit of a squabble occasionally over the rates, with the piecework rates.
Were there trade unions in the factory?
No unions at all. It was a federation. It was what was called the Pen Workers Federation.
What was
that? There were about, I don't know, it's five or six firms in the Birmingham area. The employers have got a federation, like an organization. They're all pen makers. They all make pens. That was the bosses' organization. They got a boss. But the workers have got like a small union to themselves amongst this group of factories. It was called the Pen Workers Federation. It wasn't affiliated with any other unions of any kind. But it was just this, I think it was about six, might have been six or seven firms, all in this business making pens.
Were there ever any strikes or disputes?
I can only ever recall one dispute. We had a chap came, he was on the board of directors, and he would be, I suppose, what you'd call I think he was an accountant. Well, he was certain to do with all the money side of it. And he tried to bring, well, like all new brooms, he tried to bring, introduce, a different scheme, different ideas. Well, everybody does, I suppose, when they got a new job, they try to bring their ideas in. And they had the women just spontaneous, just all walked out. The down tools. And this Mr. Williams, his name was, Mr. Williams went down the factory with, I don't know who it was with, perhaps two or three of the foremen. And the girls had congregated into a crowd, a bit of a crowd, you know. And I think it frightened him, because he looked for him. I think they could have got their hands on him. They'd have lynched him, you know. But he was as white as a sheet. He walked back up the factory. I think he was glad to get up in the office. Nobody ever laid a finger on him, you know.
Were they shouting at him?
Yeah, you know, calling him all, you know, rude names.
What were they calling him?
A word like bastard was never used in those days. Very seldom. I say never used, but it was used. But if you call anybody a bastard in those days, then that's an excuse. If he cut your head off, you say, well, he asked for it, you call him a bastard. I never used words like that. But, just ordinary swear words, nothing really. But they were a rough lot, you know, the girls. Good-hearted, but they were a rough
lot. Were you part of this crowd?
No, nothing to do with us. See, we had nothing to do with the peace fair. No, you're distant, no concern about that.
So did he back down?
I don't know what happened in the end. I think there's a compromise, like there always is, you know. But I could see him now. I saw him come up out the factory, and he was whiter than white, you know. He
was really close.
This would be about 1941. This would be about 41, 42. So I went to the Navy in 42.
So you were in this factory from 40 to 42?
Yeah.
In the same factory?
Yeah. I worked there all that.
As the setbacks came in the war with Dunkirk and so on, did the pressure in the factory increase to keep up with the war effort?
Yeah, they kept what few things they'd done for export. They sort of phased it all out, and they went entirely over to war production. Then, you know, they did. Lots of small, it was all metal press work, you see, the firm made. It was all to do with metal pressing. And there'd be all sorts of things they'd make. You wouldn't know what they were for, you know, little pressing. Nobody, they'd say, oh, that's for them, you see. But you wouldn't know exactly what they use them for. There's all sorts of things.
And you hardly had any bombs in this area?
No. Albury, I don't think there might have been the odd bomb dropped. And further out towards where we lived, there were some landmines dropped. But they dropped the landmines, they used to call them landmines. They were on parachutes. And I think it was two. They got caught up on some either overhead electric cables or telephone. And they never exploded. But there was never anything. I can't recall anything. The nearest to us for the bombing was Smerwick. That was adjoining Langley. There were a few bombs dropped in Smerwick. And then you moved then into Birmingham proper, you know. You weren't far away from it.
So did you feel much fear from the bombs?
Well, what we used to do, we were on fire watch. We used to go up the pub till if there's no alert, it's all right to go. The chap in charge had an old pension. Well, he was knocking on for the pension. He'd say, we go up the pub till 10 o'clock. And if there's an alert, then of course we'd get back down to the factory, you know, sharpish. Like, but unless there was an air raid, there was nothing to worry about, really. One night we. The sirens went, and Mr. Hall, his name was, an old man. Well, he's an old man to us, you know, he must have been 62. And he said, well, I'll walk around the factory, lad, so put your tin hats on. So I'll walk around the factory. And that was the night this and the aircraft shell came down. Well, we were walking down the side of a low wall, and we heard this thing whistle, you know, like a whistle. And he said, "There's a bomb down," and he pushed us all down. And of course, it was a bang, but it was, you know, out of harm's way. And we were told the next day that it was an anti-aircraft shell, unexploded shell. But there was nothing, I can't recall anything being bombed in that area. And there were some good targets, you know, they could have made them, like Albright and Wilson, the phosphorus. They got a fire there every day, they got their own fire brigade, they always got the fire engine out. But they cope with their own fires for the most part, with the phosphorus, because phosphorus is very volatile stuff, in the, as you know. But no problem. So it didn't last all that long, the raids in the Midlands. And when they had all that raid, there's another occasion when they came over in daylight. There's only one plane. One plane came over in daylight, and you could see it, and there's nobody, nothing. Everybody was thinking, "Well, why is it he's allowed to get away with it?" And he came over the Austin Motor Works, and we saw him. We didn't know he was over the Austin Motor Works, but we saw him over, and he dived and dropped a bomb on there. On the Austin Motor Works, just one bomb, and off his carpet. I don't know whether they ever caught him before he got back, but there was a bomb drop. Now, since the war, after the war, in the last, 10 years or so, I've worked with a chap. I ended up working for the electricity board, and I worked with a chap, and he was telling me, his uncle worked at the Austin Motor Company. When the alarm went, the siren sounded, he said, "Oh, I'll just go back and get something." He'd forgotten something. And he went back, and they dropped the bomb, and he was killed. He's the only one killed in the factory.
That's the Austin Motor Works in Birmingham?
Outside Birmingham, a place called Longbridge. It's not, it's within the boundaries of Birmingham. But not near the centre.
When would that have been, when that lone bomber came over?
I would think that would be about 1941. When 41, that would be. Might have been 41. It would be 40 or 41. I should think 41. Yeah.
So what did people in the area feel about the bombing? Was their morale good or not?
Oh, there never any... everybody was... One just went about the business best they could. Yeah. It didn't... You never heard anybody say, "Oh, well, I think we ought to pack in." There never any thought of anybody giving it up, you know? And it wasn't just bravado. It was just... People just went about their normal business as much as they could, you know? People got to work and... they didn't fire watching, you know?
So you didn't get people saying, "We can't stand this"?
Oh, no. I never came. Well, of course, I wasn't... We didn't live near... If you lived in the centre of the town and the centre of the city, you may get... obviously, you're going to get people with a bit of pressure. But for the most part, on the outskirts, you see, there wasn't too much, you know. It was worrying to see all these... You know, you're worried about... You're concerned with all the fires and that. My dad... He worked for a building firm, because he came out the mines, and they travelled to Coventry every day, clearing up the bomb damage. They couldn't stay at night because there's nowhere for them to stay. But they would work all day on the bomb damage. He was down there for 12 months.
Did he say anything to you about it?
Well, he's come back with some terrible stories.
Such as?
Well, a lot of it was rumour, you see. You could never... There's a lot of rumours going about, because then, you know... And he did say that in one, there was a shelter, a direct hit on the shelter. But whether that was true or just a rumour, I don't know.
Can we go on to the Navy now, and can you tell me how you came to go into the Royal Navy?
Well, you registered when you were 17 and a half. They brought the age, that was the age of registry. And then you just wait for your medical. And if you passed okay, in my case I passed, and they say, what's your preference? What do you want? Which would you most prefer, the Army, Navy or the Air Force? In my case, I said the Navy. I was always mad on ships and tea. I'd only ever been to the sea, in the sea about three times before I left school. And I was always interested in ships and shipping, you know. And especially the old grain races and things before the war, you know. And they used to race from Australia with the grain. I was always interested in that sort of thing. And I preferred the Navy. And I was like, of course, they say, but you had a choice, but it wasn't necessarily get what you wanted. You know, if they wanted Navy at the time, which they did when I was called up, they were... So I learned after that they were just in the process of putting more armament on the merchant ships, and there were more new ships coming through, like Liberty ships, and that. So they needed more Dems gunners. And it just happens that the time I was called up to the Navy coincided with that they needed more chaps. Up till then, it had been, they're all volunteers in the Dems from general service in the Navy. But from a certain date, they said they just call up, you know, conscripts were just sent on the merchant ships. We didn't think anything odd about it because we didn't know at the time, you know, but up till then there'd always been volunteers from the Navy. That's how they got them in. Of course, they didn't need quite so many, but as the new ships came through, you know, Liberty ships, of course, they were turning them out like, you know, they turn out cars now. And that's where they, you know, and there's more guns on the ships. So, I mean, where there'd be, say, two or three or four chaps on the average ship, when they got, say, four, six, perhaps six Oerlikon, 20mm cannon on, and perhaps a gun forward and a gun aft, you need about 10 men then. 10 to manage, you know, to keep watches and things. But when the armament was just a gun on the stern and perhaps a couple of Lewis guns or something, there wasn't much of a guns crew. There were perhaps two, perhaps a gun layer in there. But as these ships came, new ships came in, the average ship, like a Liberty, would be 10 gunners on there. Smaller coasters, perhaps four.
What was your training like in the Navy?
Well, the first we went to Butlin's camp at Pathelli, North Wales. That's the way I went when I was called up. And you did 6 weeks seamanship training.